You can concentrate on the breath, just the inhalation, exhalation. You get very learning to relax with the inhalation, exhalation. You can use a mantra. You can say Bhutto, or I used to use peace. Like I used to inhale peace, exhale peace, and that gets tranquility. Also, you can use it with the sound of silence. So inhaling from the beginning to the end of the inhalation, you're with the silence. The beginning of the exhalation to the end of the exhalation, that also works. Also, when you're doing walking meditation, listen to the sound of silence, determine to when you're at this end of the path, and tune into the sound of silence, and then with each step the silence down to the end, turning around so that the silence is like a background for the walking. It's also very good. Remember, the sound of silence is like it embraces, so it doesn't exclude, so it's very useful, and even when you go home and you go to your work and see if you can use it, you know, just to keep kind of tuning in, so that then you'll find that it helps a lot in just dealing with not getting, and that when in stopping the kind of habitualness of things, or the routines of life, or just getting kind of just going through the, you know, perfunctory way going through things. You know, you've got the silence, meetings and things like this. It helps to compose yourself. And if you're kind of in a state of anxiety, or you're particularly kind of disturbed by what they're saying at the meeting, you can retire into the silence. Works very well that way too. Sometimes hard to remember. The real challenge is when you're really upset, emotionally upset, and then the silence.
You said, I think it was on Thursday night, a little regretfully, you said sometimes even monks and nuns spend quite a few years unable to break through the, I can't remember what the expression you used, but the bubble of self. And then you were talking about the silence, which is the kind of almost the enlightened silence. And I wondered how is it that this bubble is broken? If we're living in a sense from the silence, and yet we can't break through this image or this bubble of self. How do the two connect, the silence and the breaking of this illusion of self?
Well, with investigating, really, you know, a lot of people don't see any value in using the silence, so that they get committed to various practices and or techniques. They'll get very involved with a technique you go through various stages. It seems but we all have to face the, you know, like a lot of us come in to the monastic life quite inspired. And so that that kind of inspiration can carry you quite a ways, and when you're inspired, then you really like to meditate, and when you get some kind of tranquility and you feel you get in places or that, then that keeps your interest going. But then after a while, all these things don't work anymore, unless you really, you know, really had insight into the way things are. Just inspiration, and say idealism, and that will work for a while. That can oftentimes get you going. But my particular approach is always, I've always been very much a spiritually oriented person. You know, I've always wanted to penetrate the spiritual questions. So like the unconditioned and Nibbana, all these have fascinated me from the beginning. You know, so right from the very beginning I had this quote, you know, there is the unborn, uncreated, that really fascinates me. But some people don't find that at all inspiring, you know. So that some people want a community life, or are looking for some kind of lifestyle in the world, and there's different reasons, people have different reasons for doing this. But I haven't really emphasized using the sound of silence until fairly recently, because when I first started using it, I just wanted to, before I started teaching too much about it, I wanted to test it out long enough to know what the long-term results are, you know. So sometimes I'd mention it for quite a few years, but some people, I never gave it the significance that I do now. So that some people have never really caught on to it or appreciated it. Or they just think it, you know, they can just say it's just one of Ajahn Sumedho's funny things. But in terms of practice, you know, I find it, you know, very powerful for me in gaining confidence and in really penetrating the illusions of self and the worldly conditions. Also, emotionally, we're conditioned for something else. You know, so there, you know, one, people do get, you know, sometimes one wants to just get high in meditation. You know, like really get blissed out, that's a very strong attraction, you know, to. They see meditation as maybe an opportunity to kind of get very high, very kind of refined, and so that just increases the sense of a self, this desire for rapture and for bliss and for a kind of or tranquility. And the middle way is a subtle one, because it's not high, not low. It's ordinary. It's so ordinary that we don't see it. You know, the sound of silence is so ordinary, nobody pays attention to it. Until you say, have you ever heard that sound? But it's been going on ever since you were born. I mean, it isn't that it's not there. It's just you don't. It's like you know, the space and all that is so present that you don't pay attention, don't notice. And so this awakened state, you know, you begin to really, the Buddha's wake up, pay attention, contemplate existence. So you're learning to tune in on that level. And then also, as a transcendent, as the door, the gate to the deathless, when you use it, contemplate it in that way, it works very well. Because I'm not talking about the deathless as some, you know, ultimate thing that one is going to realize after years of meditation, but contemplating what that is experienced now. You see, so it's like a conundrum where you, what is the deathless if Dhamma is here and now, apparent here and now, timeless? What can it be then? You know, you're kind of, you know, if you keep putting it off for some possible future experience, then that's one way of just dismissing it or seeing it's not worth bothering with. But for me, it was always this questioning, looking into and seeing and just observing experience so that I more awake to what is immediate that I might never have noticed before, because it's so close, so here, so present, so kind of integrated into this moment that I wouldn't notice. Where, say, if I'm trying to get like different levels of concentration, that puts me into this state of doing something in order to get a result, and then that kind of mental state is always it's always looking to the future for results, so I've seen that the gaining mind, the idea of attaining, were not helpful perceptions to me in this life, because that's how I'm conditioned by my culture and education, is to gain. So the idea of relinquishment began to help me a lot. The idea of, like, I remember when you read Visuddhimagga or something like that, reading that years ago, and you get this idea that jhanas are things you gain. And so I remember putting in so much effort to gain these states. And it's just, you know, sometimes you actually could feel you gained something, but then because the whole attitude was based on the illusion of a self getting something, it had no, you know, you'd lose it. You'd feel if you gain something, you'd lose it. So I noticed that this gaining mind was not to be the kind of basis for practice. So this is why I emphasize gratitude, contentment, patience, things that where you feel a sense of ease in the present, where your mind is open and willing to awaken to what the way things are now, rather than following the illusion of gaining and achieving and becoming and feeding those kind of mental conditions. And then like when you develop, like contentment actually is like pity. It's one of the jhana factors. To be content means not to, you don't gain it. You more or less learn how to let go of things. That restlessness and the gaining mind and the desire to achieve and all this intense, you know, trying and seeking to develop a sense of contentment in the present, of just being and content with just this with the body and the feeling of sense of just relaxing and peacefulness in the posture in the present, then the happiness, the sukha comes, and then and then more and more you feel this one pointedness and equanimity, and the sound of silence comes very strong in there, because when there's no grasping and there's no striving, then you're in a relaxed, an attentive state, but relaxed, and therefore you begin to notice this sound of silence. That's how I experience it anyway. So I also used to love to listen to myself inwardly. So, you know, I was, you know, this sense of listening, the sotawanta, if I was in an emotional state or something and my ego was very active, then I'd listen to it. And I'd even, you know, make it say things to me. So, you know, like if I was in a, angry with somebody, I'd listen to my ego saying, I'm really angry, that person really shouldn't have done that, and that's unfair, it's not right, and I'm really fed up with that person, and I'm just, you know, had enough, and I just listen to try to give voice to this anger, listening inwardly. And then just more like a neutral listener, not a judging listener. You know, whatever this my ego is saying, I'm just listening to it. It's not making any kind of moral judgments about it or about myself my ego, but just learning to listen, to hear it. And then after a while it would wear out, you know, the kind of anger once you've kind of accepted it, and then it kind of has its moments, then it stops. And then there's this not anger. You know, so that it was through listening to anger and to non-anger that I could really see what my ego is in terms of experience, and how, you know, it could say all kinds of things and outrageous things and carry on, you know, and I just let it. I wasn't trying to be a reasonable, senior monk, trying to be fair and nice about everything and compassionate. I'd really try to bring up, you know, put it into the terms of anger without judging it, you know, without making personal judgments about it. And because sometimes, you know, when we fool ourselves a lot, when we want to act like, we don't want to sometimes see the nastiness in ourselves. And so we try to kind of edit it a bit, you know, and make ourselves sound at least, you know, reasonable we can admit we're angry, but after all, you know, everybody gets angry, that kind of thing. but just quite willing to listen to it, to its rubbish, to its nastiness, without judging it. And so I'd kind of deliberately do that, and it would wear out. And I found that was a way to not suppress or not be afraid anymore, but not to believe it either. So whatever it said, I'd listen to it, but I knew that it wasn't, it was just a habit. You know, it wasn't a person, it wasn't a wasn't mine, wasn't me, wasn't anything. It's just when anger, when you give voice to anger, that's what it says. You know, I hate, I don't like, I'm fed up. Self-consciousness, resentment, jealousy, all these emotions, I do that. But then it always take me to emptiness again. So that these emotions were not just denied or I wasn't trying to get rid of them, but to learn how to accept the conditioned realm within the unconditioned. So just by this mindfulness and this listening and attention, then establishing the kind of base, you know, the present moment of being present at this moment is establishing in this unconditioned, where the conditions then are in a perspective of, you know, that you're very much aware of the anicca dukkha anatta of them. And then I'd say, well, okay, this anger is here, so listen to it, and then I just kind of contemplate, well, this anger, you know, it's going on, but there's this, that which is aware of anger isn't angry, is it? You know, so I'd kind of, you know, inform myself that this mindfulness isn't angry. That which is aware of anger isn't angry. The emotion is angry, that's it. It's anger. Anger's like this. So more and more, rather than identifying with the emotion and complicating that, I begin to trust in just being the awareness, because that would never be stained by the emotional stuff that's going on. That's why when I talk about this purity, it's pure. You know, your true nature is pure, stainless. Nothing can stain it. Nothing can harm it. You know, so the only problem is we forget about it, and we get attached to the things that are stained and have qualities and of pleasure and pain and beautiful and ugly. But as soon as we awaken, then when we let go of those, you know, we begin to realize letting go of the condition, and then we're back to the original nature of purity, which we can trust. And that's what is a refuge. Buddha, knowing the Dhamma.
I just wondered, do you find yourself when you're with people who are, difficult, and who may be projecting anger on you and really going at you, that even though you're observing what's coming up, do you have a physiological reaction? I mean, that people pick up on, red face, huff and snort or something, I don't know, but do people pick up on that, or is it the whole physiological being calm?
Well, let's say I'm better than I was. I found, this is where it's a real challenge, because this awakened state is it's so easy to, especially when somebody's being very saying very hurtful things, and you find, you know, you really you feel really hurt, and it brings up this sense of being really wounded, and it's so easy to give that your attention, to attach to that. You know, so this is where this because you feel it. You know, it's not just a intellectual thing, but you feel it in your body, it really hurts you. But I found that through always, it's like even if I at moments or even at, you know, a long time, I forget and get caught up in my wounds and my hurts. But there's always something in me now that doesn't really believe it anymore, and knows how to deal with it more, honestly and more immediately. So it's just through really practicing with it that you and investigate, you gain increasingly more confidence. And then after a while you just think, that's the only thing worth doing, you know. I used to get intimidated, like people say, you're an angry man. And I'm like, maybe I am. Or they say, you're in denial. So I thought, I'm not. I'm not. But I'd let myself get kind of intimidated and consider, because how other people see me sometimes when they now is the time for feedback. You know, everybody wants this is the jargon of the age. We give feedback now. So at one time everybody was afraid to give me any feedback. Now they're not. So that this feedback is where because I wasn't really used to it, then I tended to question it, and I could allow myself to get intimidated by it. But it would also really help me to see where some subtle defilements too that would arise, like wanting to be liked, or wanting to have a peaceful community, there's kind of even good things that the ego can produce that are good, so you don't really think of them as ego. They seem just normal inclination. But I can see even the desire for wanting a peaceful, harmonious community, grasping that one is takes you to when it's not peaceful, you get very upset. And then it's easy to blame. It's easy to blame if somebody is, if you all agree that this person is the cause. But oftentimes not that easy. Or you can think maybe that you're the cause. Maybe I'm the cause of this through my blindness. Because I'm, several generations older than most of the people I live with. So that these kind of doubts would come in. And they would, and I could allow myself to be intimidated by them. But now, my confidence, after being allowing, giving in, and seeing the result, I realize I don't have to do that anymore. That if I just trust more in this refuge and with mindfulness, this simple way of meditating, it's. People can say what they want, I'll listen to them too, just like I listen to myself. But the tendency to allow myself to be intimidated is, I say, minimal now. But it's been, you know, it's been not all that easy to do. But you can do it, that's the thing. And I figured this out all on my own. I mean, no one's teachers ever taught me this. This is through experience. So it isn't like a, you know, that's why I would allow myself to get intimidated just to see what the result would be. Like I noticed that for a while I could see that like in the community certain people resent me a lot. So then you think that they act in ways or say things that convey this message, and then they can list all kinds of mistakes that I've made over the years and to prove their point, and then that puts me, you know, I can easily get defensive over things like that, and so I can see these tendencies, you know, to get defensive when I'm kind of being criticized for, you know, things I have done that were wrong, you know, not to, they aren't, that is not true, but it's this tendency to always want to dwell on what, to make such a big thing about the mistakes, and because then that the reaction is from me to want to point out all the things they've done wrong, you see, or the things I don't, or resent about them. So then I've noticed that when you have, when you meet and you on that level, that it just creates more resentment. You know, I just don't see the good result from it. So, and even though you said trying to be honest, I'm just being honest. I'm saying what I feel and this kind of thing, and you. But it leaves you still, you know, it doesn't resolve. At least in me it wouldn't. It doesn't. And so then I realized that maybe, you know, if I do that to somebody and then they do that to me, just it gets us nowhere. Increases the sense of alienation. So then I've put enormous effort to not do that, not to dwell on what I don't like about people, and which doesn't mean I'm denying that, but I don't find any value in keep holding on to those memories or those ideas I have, and to try to remember to have the more mudita style of rejoicing in their goodness. And I find that much more, you know, beneficial to me, and I hope to them too, because then, you know, you're not really making problems about the past. You're not, you know, and you can apologize, you know, for the things I've done in the past. I'm quite willing to, you know, apologize for it, but a lot of things also are just, you know, projections that people have, you know, and they just hold on to resentments, and so I've seen that in myself, how to let go of that whole pattern of resentment, and to not create anymore, not believe in the resentments that might come up, not to empower them anymore.
I find that when I'm doing therapy with people and I understand the personal dynamics, and I have sort of a professional detachment that I can take almost anything. I can take because people will often lash out. But in my mind, I know their personal anatomy. I know where it comes from. So it doesn't really hurt. But this is not the case with me when I'm with family.
Yeah.
My Italian relatives, you know, that it's really, I mean, they you know, if they love you, they really lash out. I mean, they don't really hold it in at all. I mean, a lot of the stuff comes out. And that's a completely, I don't have that detachment. And it really gets shaken.
Good practice for you. you could try it, you know, to use the sound of silence, and by also accepting the emotional shattering for what it is. And after a while, that I think that, you know, I can see you're not, because you're not reinforcing the habit, then the tendency to feel that way, you know, it fades out. Isn't being supported anymore. Because it's some, you know, the closer they are, you know, like when you know somebody's a, you know, and they're not close, but they're, you know, somebody accuses me of something, you know, and they're not, you know, they're just somebody doesn't know anything. It's easy to not feel it or even laugh, you know, think it's rather funny that they think that. But when it gets into the closer the relationship, all that, then it, you know, because you're then you feel. You know, you can really be hurt by the people closest to you.
Especially our
own children.
Yes. They know about quick point.
Is that right?
I think we're enjoying the time when it becomes much easier.
Well, that is the Kama Vipaka, you see, so it's putting it in that perspective rather than as a personal, when you're making new Kama with the Kama Vipaka means you're attaching to it out of ignorance, so then you're either indulging in it heedlessly or you're trying to resist it, then you're creating new Kama with the Kama Vipaka. But if you're mindful of the vipaka in the present, then you're actually making, you're not making any karma with it anymore. So that's why it fades out. It has you're not connecting to it by accepting it. See, connecting to it out of ignorance means that you're either indulging in it, or you're trying to deny it, and the middle way is neither indulging or in denying. Yeah, that's probably, I found that helpful, especially to stop this obsessive, you know, tendency, compulsiveness. Because like you probably have seen yourself how even meditation can become just, you know, very compulsive act. You know, I've got to meditate and And then you think, I didn't do my meditation today. So everything becomes, you know, it's just another thing that you have to do in your life. And so nothing is a good reflection. If you find that it helps to center yourself, if you know, to stop that tendency towards compulsivity. I remember just thinking, you know, just sitting, remember in the early days at Wat Pa Point, I'd be so compulsive about everything. I couldn't just be an ordinary monk and just live a mindful life in a monastery. I've got to do this, I've got to do that. Because I'd pushed myself for so many years in lay life. And then, that same habit was as strong as ever in the monastic life. So after a while, you know, the results of this compulsivity, and then I found suddenly I read a Zen book about not having to do anything, being nobody, doing nothing. Something to me, it's kind of like that. So I remember sitting there in the meditation hall and, you know, this kind of, I've got to meditate feeling come over, and I think, no. Not anybody, not doing anything. And suddenly I just felt this sort of kind of real ease, you know. What a relief, you know. Going nowhere, not getting anything, doing nothing. And suddenly I just kind of feel really happy, you know, quite relaxed. Because it stopped, you know, suddenly I just stopped this grinding pushiness of my mind. And then it's, you know, it was that tendency towards achievement would easily take me over again. And everything I touched was always seemed to be stained with this compulsivity. And so then even, you know, I try doing nothing, it become compulsive. After a while it didn't work, because then don't have to do anything, don't have to do anything. But, so then more, rather than just relying on it, on a technique, more, the techniques help, but then you can easily get attached to the technique. Like I remember when I first had the insights into letting go, it really worked. All I had to say is let go, and I could let go of things. I thought, this is wonderful. All I have to do is say to myself, let go, and it seems to work, you know. So I keep saying let go, and after a while it didn't work. Because I become, you know, kind of habituated. It became like, I'd be attached to the idea of letting go. And where at first it wasn't, it was actually, you know, quite, you know, it worked, and it was because I'd always been, never thought of things in that way, you know, of letting go. I was thinking of, you know, not letting go, really keeping with something. But then reflecting on the experience of non-attachment, letting go, as more and more you inform yourself through awareness when there is non-attachment and when there is. Where if you're just depending on a gimmick or on a upaya all the time, that it'll help to a certain degree, and then it won't. So this is where this investigation, you know, you really know your mind, how it works, through methods and that, but through real direct insight, seeing the reality of it. So now, say, there's a knowing when there's attachment. I know what attachment is or non-attachment as experience. And then the need for they letting go or that isn't, we're saying that isn't necessary anymore. Don't need to do that. I can, but it's not necessary to use it. That is like I use the Four Noble Truths and the dependent origination, my main, but all of that is just because with Dhamma, Dhammanupassana, and then you're also reflecting on the conditioned, the unconditioned, and that's where it really takes you to a profound profundity, because like I find using the Dhamma language, that's a very skillful way to train yourself to think